I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and it's time for our Monday All Things Political. David K. Johnston is our guest this hour. He has spent 50 years doing investigative reporting. He started when he was 18 years old, and he's now the founder of DCReport.org. He's reported for the San Jose Mercury, the Detroit Free Press, the Los Angeles Times, Philadelphia Inquirer. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for work exposing tax dodges and loopholes, a longtime reporter for the New York Times. He teaches at Syracuse University College of Law, and he's author of a number of books. We've interviewed him about all of these, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And he has written, most recently, The Making of Donald Trump. At the end of this year, he will publish The Trump Factor. And we have a lot to talk about today. I guess we'll start with what has happened to decency. Our guest has said that Congress needs to investigate whether White House aides are indeed engaged in extortion on behalf of the president. If so, which aides? The Trump travel ban has taken effect, and we will talk about that. The G20 summit will take place in Germany. President Trump is meeting with Vladimir Putin, and we'll ask what might be discussed. A voter fraud commission has been asking for information about every voter, names, birth dates, voting histories. There is concern that this information may be used to suppress voters, and all states are not complying with the voting commission's request. We will talk about that with David. Mitch McConnell has delayed the health care vote, and we're now hearing that the president would like to repeal Obamacare and then later replace it. That's on our agenda as well. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for David K. Johnston. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K. Dunn Show. And you can reach us all of those ways. David K. Johnston, happy almost 4th of July.
Well, glad to be here with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, good to have you with us. Well, let's start with, you know, what's making all the news before we get into substantive issues, although this is also important. What has happened to decency, David?
Well, I think that's actually one of the most fascinating questions going on in this administration and in our culture. Clearly, we are a country with very, very deep divisions among people. My local newspaper here in Rochester, New York, ran a story yesterday about a man who's put up some really gravely offensive sort of messages supporting Donald Trump on his fence. And he asserts, you know, I have a First Amendment right to do this. Well, no one was questioning that. His neighbors were questioning whether children should have to look at this stuff. And his response is, well, I defend in every way his right to do what he's doing. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't criticize him for not being civil. There's no reason that we can't have civil debate and discussion about the issues, because that's how the founders intended us to be. They believed that information and rational debate would lead to the best choices.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried about this ad, this doctored video that appears to promote violence against CNN? Does that have significant ramifications, David?
Yes, and it is part of Donald's overall campaign. Donald does not believe in fundamental American values. I mean, it's really unfortunate that during the campaign, nobody asked him some basic questions. What does the what is the job description of the president, and what does it say? What about the First Amendment, et cetera, et cetera? I was just today working on the chapter in my next book about how Trump has worked very hard to suppress free speech in the Middle East, something that's been totally missed in the news, like a lot of things that I've read about. And, Donald believes that no one should write stories that don't say what he wants them to say. Or as he told me when he called me a year ago, threatening to sue me, if I don't like the way you write it, I'll sue you. Mm-hmm. He's the only politician in 50 years at this, who's come within 100 miles of a statement like that. I mean, you know, it doesn't mean you can't say, I'm unhappy about this, or blankety blank this or that. Right. But, you know, Donald is fundamentally, he's a bully, and he operates on the belief system of a mob boss. While proclaiming himself to be a Christian, he says people who turn the other cheek are fools and idiots and schmucks, And his policy, as just articulated by the daughter of a minister, the Deputy White House Press Secretary, Ms. Huckabee, said, you know, he hits back, he gets revenge.
And you said in your book, The Making of Donald Trump, that two of his mottos are, and he does seem to live this way, always get even and hit back harder than you were hit.
Yep. And that's exactly what we're seeing happen. This video that he put out with the CNN head on the other person goes in line with his saying during the campaign to the people in the crowd, beat that person up, I'll pay your medical bills. Boy, anybody who, and your legal bills, anybody who thought Trump would actually pay their legal bills is going to be very sorry. But beyond that, what kind of leader in a democratic society makes calls to violence? I mean, there are some fringe people out there who have done so, but no other candidate that I know of for president of the United States, unless you go all the way back to Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm. So do you worry that it will have, the Committee to Protect Journalists said, targeting individual journalists or media outlets or on or offline creates a chilling effect and fosters an environment where further harassment or even physical attack is deemed acceptable? Do you worry about that happening, David? Not that it already hasn't happened to a reporter in Montana.
Right. Well, we're going to see people acting on this, and it's awful, and this is not going to, it's going to get worse before it gets better. What I'm more concerned about is the number of people who, listening to that message, think that violence against those they disagree with is appropriate. Mm. It's not. And in line with that, you know, the other day in May, when Trump and his entourage were in Saudi Arabia, his Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, said on a television interview with CNBC right after he got back, you know, it was just a fascinating thing to me that not one person was out protesting. There wasn't a single guy with a bad placard. And Becky Quick, the host, pointed out that in Saudi Arabia, demonstrations are not allowed, that people are jailed. I mean, it's a country that jailed a poetry professor for belonging to a group that said individuals should have, you know, civil rights. And the response of Wilbur Ross was, well, in theory, that may be true, but we have in this administration people who are utterly clueless about the realities of the world. And as a result, their misperceptions, their lack of knowledge lead to terrible policy choices. And you don't see any of these people standing up and saying, stop the violence. Not one of them.
Well, we're also spending so much of our time on stories about his tweet about CNN, his tweet about Joe Scarborough, and his co-host, horrible statements that he made about her. It gobbles up all of our time, and we've got healthcare to deal with and the G20 summit to deal with and what's going on in the Middle East and what about the war in Afghanistan and what about so many issues. Instead, we're consumed by this. It's not very good for us, is it?
No, and a lot of what we're being diverted to is really sort of ephemera. I mean, it's, you know, the observation was made long ago, and I'm trying to remember the name of the Roman Greco-Roman historian that, you know, in small things we understand larger things, in writing about Peter the Great. But in Trump, we see that here is someone who is petty and vindictive, but who also understands how to direct the herd, the news herd, to the issues he wants and away from the ones he doesn't. So he's currently calling for just repeal Obamacare. Don't replace it, just repeal it. Well, that's a death sentence to thousands and thousands of Americans. If you have chronic disease, cancer, diabetes, that's not treated in emergency rooms. And if we take away the care that roughly, under that plan, 1 in 10 Americans would lose their health care, 1 in 10. That is sentencing lots of people to their deaths. And for what? To finance a tax cut for the richest among us. I mean, Warren Buffett pointed out yesterday to PBS, he paid $680,000 in Obamacare taxes and thinks that's perfectly appropriate. Now, I don't expect everybody to agree with him, but $680,000 to a man worth $77 billion is an irrelevancy in his life. And the idea that if you make $300 million a year, almost $1 million a day, that you might pay $10 million more in taxes because of all the benefits you got from living in this country so that we have close to universal health care, it doesn't make a difference in your life, and it doesn't make a difference in what's going on in our society. And well, we've lost sight of that notion, and Trump encourages it.
And you only had about 12 to 17% of the American public agree that this health care plan that the Republicans had put together behind closed doors was satisfactory. Nobody liked this very much.
Which means a majority of Trump supporters don't like it.
Right.
But understand that you know, when you see Donald Trump acting the way he is, he's being Donald. He's being the guy I've known for almost 30 years. And he has no respect for our Constitution. He has no respect for his fellow Americans. He thinks only about himself. He has a history of denigrating his own family members who, you know, his grown children are very close to him because he provides them with incredibly great incomes and lifestyles. If his two sons had to suddenly go out in the world with a resume and look for work and had to do so blind, nobody knew who they were, they wouldn't be anywhere near where they are now.
Let's talk about money. You wrote a piece recently that Congress needs to investigate whether the White House aides are indeed engaged in extortion on behalf of the president. If so, which aides, and how the White House has become Trump Incorporated profit center?
Well, extortion is just one part of a larger scheme. You know, there are three emoluments clauses in the Constitution, and the discussion we've had publicly has been not about the most important one, in my view. The most important one says that the president shall receive no emoluments beyond his salary from the United States or any of them, meaning the individual states. Well, every time Donald Trump goes to Mar-a-Lago or his Jupiter, Florida golf course or his Bedminster golf course, the U.S. government rents rooms, buys meals. To follow him on the golf course, the Secret Service pays full retail to rent golf carts. Those are all emoluments to the president that clearly violate the Constitution. And Trump has made it clear that if you're in business and you want to be in his good graces, you stay at his hotel in Washington. You rent function rooms at his hotel in Washington. There have been journalists who've gone to the bar and hung out there and been astonished at all the corporate people who were there. The Kuwaiti government moved its annual celebration of the liberation of Kuwait, which is really a family business posing as a country, during the George H.W. Bush administration, from the Four Seasons Hotel in Washington to the Trump Hotel. And if you want to be in Donald Trump's good graces and you need something in business, then you better be doing business with him. This is a kleptocracy. This is not a government run for the benefit of the American people. It's a government run for the benefit of Donald Trump and his family. And I frankly don't understand why the really well-known, principled Republicans in this country have, by and large, not all of them, but by and large, been silent about these things.
Because they have all branches of government, because they can get some legislation passed?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Basically, they have made their bed with Trump. I'm not a cynical person. I have a very optimistic guy. You can't raise eight children, and especially in a newspaper man's salary, without being an optimist. But I think that the Republicans have a problem, and that is that a large portion of their base believes that Donald Trump is this righteous family man and a fine Christian and other things I get emails about, who is trying to do the right thing for our country and save us from the Democrats who want to bring Sharia law and all these lying, mendacious journalists. And so long as they believe that nonsense, it's pretty hard for them to stand up to Trump. And so I think it's terribly important that we get a much larger segment of the population we have now to understand that you have a con man in the White House, and he's out for him. He's out for his ego, and he always has been. He's a swindler and a con artist and a friend of international drug trafficker he's been in business with, and Russian mobsters and American mobsters, and not at all someone who cares about you, no matter how much he said at every single campaign stop that I've seen, "I love you."
I remember so well, and I've asked you every time I've interviewed you about those Polish workers, and I'm wondering if they ever got paid.
Well, the Polish workers who were to be paid in 1982, $4 an hour to take down with sledgehammers a 12-story building in Manhattan so that Trump Tower could be built, were paid some of their wages. But Trump fought for 18 years in court not to pay them. A judge, a federal judge, after a trial where Trump testified, found that Trump's testimony was not credible and that he had engaged in a conspiracy to cheat the workers. And Trump then settled with the workers, but he, as he does every time he settles with people he hasn't paid, he insisted the record be sealed. That's a common business practice. He's not unusual about that. There are people in court now, news organizations and others, asking that these records be unsealed. They've been sealed for many years. They can't have any impact on what's going on. My organization, DCReport.org, is in court trying to get records from the Felix Sater case. This is the Russian mob boss's son who Trump traveled with extensively, did failed business deals with, and who got out of what should have been a long prison sentence for running a $40 million stock scam together with four of the mafia families in New York because he said he could intercept terrorist missiles going to the Middle East. And we're trying to get the records of this case unsealed. And by the way, if you think about that for a moment, if the federal government is truthful in its statement that Felix Sater did intercept shoulder-fired missiles that can bring down a jetliner that were on their way to terrorists, it means there is exactly one degree of separation between Donald Trump and Middle East terrorist arms traffickers. And that one degree of separation is his longtime close associate, Felix Sater.
What are your chances of getting those records unsealed?
Well, as a matter of law, it should be a slam dunk for us. But the Central Intelligence Agency and the Justice Department have fought this all the way along, arguing there are national security secrets involved. Well, you know, we want mostly to get at his finance records and other things that have nothing to do with his intercepting these weapons, which the government has said he did. So what's the secret? And there is a second related case in New York State Court where we also are in there with lawyers acting for us pro bono, as without pay except for, you know, we pay their expenses. And that is to get at this $250 million tax fraud where all the profits from the Trump Soho Hotel project, where investors lost money, banks that lent money lost money, but the partners, and Donald Trump was an 18% partner, made a profit, which disappeared in a recapitalization, went to one of the corrupt Icelandic banks, which we now know was under the thumb of a Russian oligarch. And that's the consistent thing you find with Donald Trump and money. You keep discovering Russian oligarchs in the background, bailing Trump out, buying his units, providing him with large sums of money one way or another, financing, according to one of his sons, his golf courses. And these raise really fundamental, serious questions. And I've said, you know, that we need to be asking ourselves, and I find it horrible to say this, but it is, I believe, imperative that we seriously consider the prospect that the man in the White House is a traitor.
Whoa.
His conduct with the Russians is very disturbing. James Clapper, the former national security director, said in Australia about a month ago that, you know, if you knew what he knew, you would think that this is a much bigger deal. And he said this is much worse than Watergate. Nobody ever suggested that Richard Nixon was not a patriot. Hmm. Never. Even the most vile hater of Richard Nixon ever thought that he wasn't a patriot. I can't say that about Donald Trump, given his request to the Russian government to interfere in our election, their clear efforts to help him, and his denial that that happened, and his denigration of people who've shown that. And, you know, it's bizarre to me, Kathleen, that we have people in this country who trust the Kremlin. I've watched network television news with people who have expressed the view, and these are generally very conservative Midwest people, that they trust the Kremlin more than they do the American FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, and the 14 other intelligence agencies. That is just stunning.
It is stunning.
And very disturbing.
Do you have confidence that Special Prosecutor Mueller is looking at all that you just mentioned?
Yes.
David, you do?
Yes. Robert Mueller ran the FBI for a long time. He was a highly decorated soldier in Vietnam whose bravery has been well documented federal law enforcement official. He has a distinguished career. You'll notice that not one person in Congress, even the most ardent Trump supporters, has raised questions about his integrity. It's only people who are utterly lacking in integrity, like Newt Gingrich, who are out there suggesting that somehow he is corrupt. And Mueller has experience both in counterintelligence and in the area where Trump is even more vulnerable, and that is financial crimes. And there are lots of things that I know about Trump's financial involvement that I don't have because I don't have subpoena power. I can't prove them to the degree that I can publish them. But there's stuff that I know prosecutors with subpoena power can get. And that's what Trump really needs to be worried about, are his many, many dealings with the Russians, as well as in the Middle East. Remember, the Saudis and others have put a great deal of money into his pocket. And if you look at his trip to the Middle East, what did he do? He took up the side of the Saudis and their allies against Qatar, where America has its most important military base. And why are the Saudis and the others imposing a blockade on Qatar? Because of Al Jazeera. And what does Al Jazeera do? It provides via satellite news to people in the Middle East who, until it came along, only got state-sponsored news and were fed official lie after official lie, and now have access to, you know, news by people who are actually quite impressive and good. And I worked for Al Jazeera America as a contract columnist for a couple of years and found them to be remarkably professional.
David K. Johnson is our guest this hour. He is going to be taking your phone calls, and we have many of them. All our lines are filled, and that's good. David has been with us many times on this program. He's currently writing a new book about Donald Trump, and he has also written The Making of Donald Trump. David has won the Pulitzer Prize for work that he did for the New York Times. He's worked for a number of publications. And he started, it's a real investigative endeavor here. He's the founder of DCReport.org, frequent TV analyst as well. We're going to welcome phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is The Ideas Network. David K. Johnson is with us now. We have many phone calls coming in. We start with Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hello, Anita.
Hello. This is absolutely riveting. I'm sitting in my garage. I'm home. I can't go in the house. I can stay with this. This is just wonderful. My question is, what do you know about the relationship, if any, between Trump and the Koch brothers? And especially, is it any different with, I think it's David that is more socially aware and a little less conservative.
Thank you, Anita.
Well, Anita, there's a column you can look up on the internet that I wrote just before Trump took office. I think it ran January 11th when I was still writing a column for the Daily Beast. And it's about Trump's encounter with a guest of David Koch, Trump biographer Harry Hurt, at a golf course in Florida. And I encourage you to read it. It's a rather revealing tale about Donald's character and reaction. The Koch brothers are serious, very competent businessmen who walk their talk. The things they believe in, they are out promoting because they think they're good for America. I don't happen to think they're right about that, but I respect that they are first-rate businessmen who take good care of their assets and generally take good care of their workers because it's good business. They have some connections to the people around Trump, but not Trump himself. And like many people who are New Yorkers, the Koch brother lives there. David doesn't have any close affinity with him. You know, Donald Trump lost Manhattan by 9-1, and the precinct Trump Tower is in, he lost 9-1.
Hmm. Before we go to another call, I want to talk about this voter fraud commission. Everybody I've talked to who's analyzed this issue has said that the amount of voter fraud in this country is absolutely minuscule. So we're paying, I don't know how much money, for a voter fraud commission asking for names, birth dates, voting histories. There's concern about what this information is being used for, understandably. And now we have pushback from states, including this comment from Mississippi's Secretary of State. They can go jump in the Gulf of Mexico, and Mississippi is a great place to launch from.
Who would have imagined that California and Mississippi would unite on
exactly
they have on this one? There has been a long-running effort now at voter suppression. In Pennsylvania, where this issue of voter ID came up, the people seeking to require you to have state identification in order to vote acknowledged they couldn't find a single case. So, you know, we got lots of problems in this country. Why are we dealing with problems that don't exist? Because the Republicans are demographically the minority party, and they know that they're going to become more and more so in the future, and the professionals in the Republican Party are trying to stem the tide. That ought to be offensive to everybody. You know, the 96-year-old woman in Tennessee who couldn't vote in the 2012 election because she didn't have a birth certificate, like many older, poor, rural Americans. That should be very troubling. The school district that I live in, all you have to do is show you have an address in the school district, and you're entitled to vote. Doesn't matter if you're a citizen or anything else. That's been very common in America for a long time. And there is exactly zero actual evidence of massive voter fraud in this country. Exactly zero evidence.
Ivy is next in Evansville. Hello, Ivy.
Hi. Just two quick comments and a question. My brother from New Jersey worked construction, and he said that it was well known among his construction circle that Donald Trump didn't pay. And I also heard someone, a pundit, say that he'll do the distraction trick, but he doesn't mind going to shock value because he doesn't care if he harms the presidency or the country. And the question I have is, what about Rudy Giuliani? I remember him being interviewed and saying something like, there's a big surprise coming. And I think it was when the email question was brought up again, that he knew about that happening. And I was just wondering if you could enlighten me on that. Thank you.
Rudy Giuliani maintains that the people misunderstand what was happening there, and he really wasn't suggesting that this was coming. And I don't know whether that's true or not. What I do know is that Rudy Giuliani has made a lot of money off his connections to Donald Trump and his connections to the absolutely corrupt guy he put in charge of the police department in New York until he went to prison, Bernie Kerik. And, well, Giuliani made a name for himself by going after mobsters. There were lots of other crimes going on that he looked the other way about, including atrocious decisions he made. You want to read a really good book on him? There's a book called Grand Illusion by the late Wayne Barrett, who was the first reporter to seriously cover Trump, and Dan Collins, Grand Illusion. The first chapter will take you back to 9/11, the day it happened, the way you and I and everybody else sort of perceives it. And the rest of the book shows how what was really going on. And it is a scary book about Rudy Giuliani, who is very much like Donald Trump. He's all about himself. He is not about public service.
And how about Chris Christie? He had a good time on the beach over the weekend, didn't he? What a story,
you know,
that is.
This is, you know, here's Chris Christie, who is got the state of New Jersey's budget now inoperable. And they had to send everybody home who isn't in certain jobs like law enforcement, because he's trying to steer money to a particular insurance company for what I'm sure we will find out eventually is an unquestionably corrupt purpose. And every state beach is shut down except the state beach in front of the official governor's seaside residence, where Christie was photographed today with his family by a very alert, smart news photographer. Somebody suggested this is progress. You know, we've gone from damaging commuters on the bridge to another problem to another problem to now shutting down the whole state of New Jersey. And so you're seeing the kind of progress that Chris Christie stands for. He's politically, he is absolute toast. I have family in New Jersey. I used to live in New Jersey. And it is astonishing to see the most stalwart Republicans, when you run into them, you just bring up Christie and just watch their anger spew out.
Thanks, Ivy, for your call. Craig in Analaska, hi.
Good afternoon. My comment is in regards to the CNN tweet. And after watching it, I decided that the Trump presidency is a lot like professional wrestling. It's fake. There's just nothing to it. There's no substance. There's just a lot of very poor entertainment. And I think until the country realizes what a farce that Trump is, we're just in for years of problems.
Yeah, I think exactly the way your guest does there, Kathleen. This is a man who is not qualified to serve on a city council. He's never done one day of public service in his life before January 20th, and I think you can make a case that he's done very little public service since then. Remember, by now, we were supposed to be tired of winning.
And yet he has what percentage of the American people, still 25% who are supportive of him?
No, I think he's higher than that. He's in the mid-30s. But what's interesting is every other politician, you know, take your governor in Wisconsin. When he got into his fight over the unions, he tried to broaden his appeal. He didn't say, I don't care about what all you people think. Now, he was successful enough that he was not recalled. Donald Trump takes no effort at all to broaden his appeal. He doesn't reach out to anybody. He just cares about his adoring fan base, and that's because Donald is about the glorification of Donald. He always has been. And that's all that matters, is his belief that, you know, he is the superior person, and you're supposed to, as one of his top White House aides said, we will all bow down to him.
And his fan base likes that because?
Yes. Oh, the people in his fan base get run down in public discussions as being stupid. They're not stupid. What they are is people who've been beaten down by 40 years of economic policies that I wrote about, showing how very subtly we've posed all these economic rules that nobody knew about till I wrote about them, to take from the many and give to the very rich few. Their incomes have gone nowhere. They're in debt. They're scared legitimately about their economics. And Trump says, I love you, I will save you, I will bring back the coal jobs, all sorts of things that he can't do and he hasn't done anything to do, even if he could. But they're desperate, and people who are desperate turn to people who make promises to them.
Thanks, Craig, for your call. Muhammad in Madison. Hello, Muhammad.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Your guest is really on the money. I remember very well during the campaign when Donald Trump, after he had done a lot of things that people thought they would never see or hear, he said, I could shoot five people in the middle of Times Square in the afternoon and I wouldn't lose the support. So those people that your guest just described, I don't know if they, obviously they don't represent a majority, because Hillary Clinton got 300 million or so more of the popular votes than he did, but he represents them, and to them, I don't believe he could do any wrong. The other thing is, Donald Trump, I don't believe Donald Trump is a guy who has a sense of humor or can take a joke. Hillary Clinton, people criticize her for her cackle. We know Barack Obama not only could take a joke, he could give one. Good. This guy, I don't believe, can take a joke, and I don't believe he, you know, to see him laugh, I cannot picture him doing that. And that's sort of a human quality that, you know, I think is valid in any leader.
Thanks, Muhammad. David?
Well, Muhammad, first of all, I hope you read The Making of Donald Trump, because a lot of those stuff you'll read. And by the way, it was a person on Fifth Avenue, not five people at
right.
Times Square. He said he could shoot. But Muhammad is exactly right. Donald has no sense of humor about himself. He's absolutely lacking in the capacity to view himself. When he was running his casinos, one day a group of the executives and managers were in a room, and they showed a clip from one of the Monty Python movies where the king is on a wooden horse, and the guy with him is slamming two coconuts together to sound like clopping feet.
Mm-hmm.
And in that scene, the king, who's in white, is the only person not covered with excrement. And everybody got the point that, you know, they were all being covered with excrement by Donald, but, you know, he was the king on the wooden horse. And when he found out about it, he was furious. He had no sense of humor at all about himself. By the way, Hillary Clinton doesn't especially have a sense of humor either about herself. She has some, but it is one of her weaknesses that she couldn't be more open to, you know, criticism and parody and people making fun of her.
Yeah, it's an excellent quality to have, isn't it?
Yes.
It's necessary, particularly if you're in government. You got to have it. Mohammed, thanks for your call. Randy in Madison, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. This might tie into the sense of humor issue, because I'm wondering if you have any insight into how much Trump hates Barack Obama and why he hates him, to the extent that, you know, lately you say, let's just repeal the health care measure and we'll come up with a new plan on the fly.
Hmm. Well, first of all, let me be real clear. Donald is a racist. And unless your definition of a racist is you have to hang somebody from a rope on a tree, Donald is a racist, always has been. He has a long history of racist comments and actions, discriminating against blacks, women, Asians, making offensive comments. And so, and remember, he's the one who started this whole phony birther thing.
Yes, he did.
Remember, and he said, oh, my investigators are finding unbelievable things, unbelievable things. Well, we've never seen anything because, of course, he just made it up. He just made it up. As to the other issue, just outright repealing Obamacare, at dcreport.org, tomorrow, the next day, depends on when my editor can do it, we will put up a story that will have some eye-popping numbers that people should learn about what it would mean to repeal Obamacare and not replace it in terms of who benefits and who bears the burden. And I promise you, it will shock your conscience.
Well, I don't quite get this, David, because 2018 or midterm elections, the Republicans can't have something that devastating that will hit their base and win elections, can they?
Well, we don't know. I mean, look, the Democrats have, for 40 years now, the Republicans have paid attention to their knitting, getting people registered to vote, getting a bench strength, starting with city councils and school boards up through government, getting a solid network. And the Democrats haven't done that.
Yes, you're right.
And in your state, instead of putting all their money into going to people who are out of work and saying, hey, Kathleen, we're going to fill your gas tank, we're going to pay you $100, and we'll fill your gas tank at the end of the day, all we want you to do is drive people to the polls. They tried to compete with the Koch brothers on buying television ads, which research shows change a tiny fraction of 1% of voters' minds.
So what's wrong with it?
I think the Democrats have a real practical problem with their capacity to win elections.
What's wrong with them? Why?
I think all of this derives back to the unintended consequences of the campaign finance reforms that came about because of Watergate. It was intended to stop things like I wrote about a Michigan legislator once who said, well, people stuff money in his pocket during campaign season. At the end of the night, he gets to a hotel. He just puts it all out on the dresser and counts it. And laws that allowed things like that, because, of course, you have no idea who's giving him money or how much or what happened to it or what it was spent on. And the result is that you got organized, wealthy people, and everybody in Congress, Democrat or Republican alike, has to kowtow to this very, very small base of very wealthy people, or you don't get on the ballot. There's a real fundamental problem. And now the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, of which the latest is Citizens United, have imbued corporations of all kinds, that includes unions, which are corporations, to put money into politics. We've given political rights to corporations, and in Hobby Lobby, we literally gave religious rights to corporations. I don't know who a corporation would pray to if it could. Mammon, I suppose. But I think these are terrible public policy mistakes, and the founders, if you go back and read their material on what they thought of as corruption, it wasn't individual acts of venality, which people in my business news tend to focus on. It was institutional corruption. And what we've created is an institutionally corrupt system where people with money control the agenda. And that's been, a real detriment to our body politic, to the growth of our economy, because people who already have money generally aren't in favor of robust competition, subject to some of my books.
Hmm.
So.
We're going to spend much of the second hour talking about the founders and some of our great presidents. LBJ once said, I'm sure you're familiar with this, that the presidency always made a man, no matter how small, bigger than he was. John Meacham will say that that's not the case now. How can you be living in that house surrounded by the kind of history, the ghosts who were in all of those rooms, the great people, all that we've lived through as a country, and not have that influence you in some way? Maybe it has. People have been saying, well, maybe he'll grow in the office. Maybe he'll realize how important this position is.
He's been there now for 5 months, and he hasn't grown one whit. Donald literally doesn't know anything. That's one of the points that I make in the making of Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump, you know, thinks Frederick Douglass is alive. You know, he's buried a couple of miles from my house, and I went to the 100th anniversary of his burial 20 years ago, roughly. He doesn't know a Sunni from a Shia. And why it's terribly, terribly important to United States interests in the Middle East. He doesn't know corporate finance. Donald's always gone saying, I'm like a really smart person. And he, you know, has created this image. He's a great negotiator. I've negotiated with Donald many times. Negotiating with him is unbelievably easy. You figure out where you want him to go. You then think about how you flatter him into getting there. And then you get him to go where you want him to go. He's brilliant at negotiating in one area, and that is where somebody is vulnerable. Like, he knows they have a deadline coming up for a balloon loan or a tax payment or they'll default on something, and exploiting that. But it's all smoke and mirrors. And Donald, he thought that Andrew Jackson, a murderous racist slave owner, would have prevented the Civil War. I mean, among the many things Donald said that are beyond the pale, that's just so laughable, and yet he's the president of the United States.
Dana K. Johnston is our guest. He wrote a book about Donald Trump, The Making of Donald Trump, which was published fairly recently, and he's working on another book on Donald Trump, which is going to be released probably at the end of this year. And we're talking with him about, well, David's been doing reporting for a long, long time, has won a Pulitzer Prize for his investigative work. He's now the founder of DCReport.org. He's reported for a number of prominent papers, the San Jose Mercury, the Detroit Free Press, Philadelphia Inquirer. And he's with us this hour talking for all things political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. The Supreme Court ruled, as you know, that large parts of the travel ban can be resumed now. And I wanted to talk to David about that. And if there are any kinds, if there can be, if they've made the decision, any suits that are ongoing right now in terms of who will not be allowed into the country. We'll discuss that with him. And the Supreme Court, too, because there are hints now that Kennedy is going to retire. Well, we'll be back with you in just one moment here on the Ideas Network. Briefly, the travel ban. While the Supreme Court has made their ruling on this, does it mean there can't be challenges to the limitation of family members, including grandparents, grandchildren, aunts or uncles, and many others, from coming into the country? Is that all legal until they review the case, David?
Well, there are already challenges to this. The state of Hawaii has filed a challenge, and I suspect there will be others. And Clarence Thomas was right that the way this order was written by the court is going to result in all sorts of litigation. But I think the most important development here is that we've now had the White House say that when the president tweets, that is a White House statement. And that means that all of his statements about Muslims and his and just flat-out bigotry, he's not – it doesn't distinguish at all. Those should come back to haunt him. I'm very surprised, frankly, that the Supreme Court took the case. You had two circuit courts out of 10 in the U.S. that addressed these issues. They both came to the same position. And normally the Supreme Court only takes cases where there's a difference between the circuits. It would have been very easy to just walk away from this. So it will be interesting to see what happens with the court majority and Chief Justice Roberts when this matter comes up in the fall, if it isn't moot by then, because the 120-day period will have passed. But, you know, doesn't make any, let's not beat around the bush here. Donald Trump doesn't want Muslims living in America. He, even though he's aggressively anti-Christian and denigrates Christians repeatedly over the years, he wants to have an America that's nominally Christian and white.
Hmm. I want to know what he and Vladimir Putin are going to be talking about at this G20 summit. Are we going to know? Will there be reporters there?
Well, there'll be reporters around the edges of this, and the White House normally releases what are called readouts of discussions and meetings with foreign leaders, but earlier this year we saw that the White House readout was useless, generalities and vagaries, whereas the Russian readout of a meeting Trump had where he disclosed national security secrets to the Russians and the real reason he fired Comey to shut down the investigation into his Russian connections. The Russians were the ones who gave us a readout with a lot of facts. If I'm Vladimir Putin, this has not turned out quite the way he hoped. I don't think Putin realized how much of a loose cannon Trump would turn out to be, as opposed to an ally in Putin's principal goals, which are get rid of NATO, expand Russia back to all the majority Russian-speaking countries that were part of the old Soviet Union, and undermine democracy everywhere, because he has said publicly, you know, he thinks democracy is basically a joke and what you need are authoritarian leaders. And he thought in Trump he would get an authoritarian. He didn't realize what he would get is an ill-informed, ignorant authoritarian who lacks the capacity to do what he's done, which is to rule his country with an iron grip and either imprison or murder those people who stand up to him.
Paul is next in Grays Lake. Hi, Paul.
Hi. You mentioned a bit ago that the one area where Trump sort of excels or does well in negotiations is when he has the other person sort of over a barrel and he knows it.
Right.
I'm concerned with regard to how they're approaching health care now that we may end up in that position, that by, you know, first repealing or breaking, you know, taking away, you then leave people in the position where it's take what we offer or nothing. And I wonder whether my concern, whether you share that. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Paul, that's a really good insight. I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but that's a really good insight. It depends here on whether the Mitch McConnell, who is a very polished politician, and Paul Ryan are going to go along with repeal without replace. They're going to think long and hard about whether they will be punished at the ballot box for that. And I think if that's what they do, that it will be an extraordinary revealing test of where the American political character is at and how much we think of ourselves as a country rather than as lucky individuals who live in this country and don't have regard for our fellow citizens.
Hmm.
A little fact, if I can.
Of course.
If we had the universal health care systems or France or Germany, it would save this amount of money. Everybody who makes under $500,000 a year could be exempted from the income tax. Now, that's a statistical measure. It's not an actual one. But just think about that. If you make less than $500,000 a year, all the income taxes you pay just go for the excess amount of money we spend on health care as a statistical matter. And if you want to grow the economy in this country, the best, fastest way to do it is to do what every other country has done. As Donald Trump said to me years ago, health care should be like the roads. When you need them, you just use them.
And we're out of time. Your favorite movie, though, something totally unrelated to what we've been talking about. I read Sophie and the Rising Sun. We should see it.
I thought it was a very good independent movie about World War II and racism and human relations and rural America. And it was a very warm, heartfelt movie by a director who I want to see more movies by.
Great. And the new book is out when, David?
The Trump Factor will be out from Simon & Schuster January 1st. And we've already sold foreign rights in several countries. The current book, The Making of Donald Trump, is in 10 languages, and
wow.
I think we may momentarily get an 11th.
Ooh. All right. David, thanks so much for being with us, as always.
Thank you.
David. David K. Johnston, our guest. He's been with us many times before. He's an investigative reporter, has been at this trade for over 50 years, very young when he started. And he has now started a new organization, DCReport.org. He's written a number of books. The Making of Donald Trump was one that was much discussed, particularly during the election season. Thanks to Colleen Henry for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air work here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your insights. I love it when the guest says you have good insights. You do. We'll be back after the news.